As we discussed ahead of this interview, the theme of our discussion is on the ideas of spinning glasses and replica symmetry breaking. But we're going to be starting in your sense a bit further back in your biography. In particular, in your autobiography for the Shaw Prize, you mentioned that upon deciding what field to pursue, you hesitated between physics and math at university. And after we were, I was wondering, right, because you had such an impact on physics, after choosing math, did you ever look back, or did you were you ever in contact with the physics world, or did you keep track of what was happening in physics as an extracurricular interest?
I had a general overall interest in the sense that I was reading a not so good scientific magazine because at the best science magazine I know of is what is it? American Scientist?
Scientific
It's
American.
Scientific American. Yeah, it's Pour la Science. Okay, it became available in France. Rather late. Okay, they have the French edition now. Of course, I could have subscribed the American edition, but it's easier to get the main science magazine, and it was not so good. But I was reading that and being made aware of the most important thing more than through a newspaper. But if you want to understand something at a deeper level, it takes a huge lot of time and commitment, and you cannot do that when you are just trying to survive, starting research, and already overwhelmed by all these people who know so much and you know so little, and it's so difficult. So I didn't study any physics at all. So, okay, I knew some very basic special relativity. That's about the most advanced it was. And I had a class in quantum mechanics, which I didn't understand a word.
So closer to your subject then, were you paying attention to the field of mathematical physics? Did you know any of the community
I didn't know anybody, and mathematics is so vast, and inside mathematics I know so little. So it works like a Brownian motion. It means you get into a group, and then people visit, and you meet them, and you talk to them, and you enlarge your interest. But it's really in order to make a plan of what you should do, you would have to have an overview, which of course I did not have. So all these things came really randomly to me. Now, it's not exactly randomly, because there are things which I felt I don't want to do. And for example, my advisor was studying analysis. He was also studying something which is called potential theory. And he wanted me to get into that. And my instinct said no, absolutely no. And I didn't. So it was a mixture of random interaction and then following my own inclination. And but there was no, I had no, no, con I knew very few people. I've known very few people because, University of Paris is so big that if you get involved, then you cannot do anything. So I didn't get involved into anything, just I belonged to a small group and I met the people there, and that's all. And it didn't happen that there was any mathematical physics.
Just to help us understand a bit further, could you tell us how would you define your community or your group? How do you self-identify?
Oh, well, the group in which that was the seminar run by Gustave Choquet, who was my advisor, and who is really a great man I greatly respect. But somehow, at the time I became his student, which is 1974, he was really at the end of his creative life. And the things being done in the seminar didn't go so far. I went there really by an accident because I studied in Lyon, and there I asked a mathematician there, where should I go? And he said, what do you like? And I say, well, I like to split. My answer was, I like to split interval into little pieces. And then he said, you should go with Choquet, and that's how it was decided. You know, if I'd gone with somebody else, it might have been very different, but that's what it was. How could I choose? Okay, so it was a good place to go because many people were visiting that group. And okay, and also I was lucky that there are some very good mathematicians joined the group later. The best of them is Gilles Pisier. You may know Gilles Pisier. He really, that was a great chance for me because he brought me in touch with really more central mathematics. Yes, but none of these things is anywhere close to ideal efficiency, as you notice. So I didn't know anything about mathematical physics.
So just as a last sort of framing question, so do you define yourself as a probabilist, as an analyst, or does this distinction doesn't make sense?
See, okay, I started as an analyst, and my taste was toward measure theory, which brought me eventually towards probability. So I had this incredible advantage to become a probabilist without having been educated like a probabilist, but having been educated like an analyst. And this is an incredible advantage because people who go into probability are educated as probabilists. So there are things which were obvious to me, to which it would have been very difficult for them to think about. And maybe my best known result, which is now everybody calls Lagrange's inequality, the first step is you have to take a convex hull. Now, when you are a student of Gustave Choquet, the first thing you know about it, you take a convex hull. Okay. But if you are not an analyst, you will never think of doing that. You see, that's, I mean, when chances has given you the proper perspective, okay, you are, that's a favorable condition. Again, it's no rational efficiency there, all chance. So I would say that I'm a failed analyst. When I liked analysis, but it's clear that the people doing analysis were far better than I was. I came in contact with Jean Bourguin very early, and then that taught me what is my real place in the world. And then there was Gilles Pisier, who was nearly at the same level. So I say, I cannot do analysis. These people are really better than I do. So I try to do something else.
So speaking of which, so, and fast forwarding a few years, you mentioned in that Shaw autobiography that you first heard about spinning glasses from Erwin Balthausen at a meeting in 1995. Can you please give us a bit more details about the context for that discussion?
Okay, I was going to meetings in Banach space theory, and I was going to meetings in an area which is called, say, high dimensional probability. It used to be called probability in Banach spaces, but then it became known as high dimensional probability. That's the spirit of it, you know, supremum of stochastic processes and this kind of thing. And Erwin did go to these meetings, and I'm not so close from what he did mathematically. It's just that he thought it could be a good idea to mention the existence of that problem. So he took me to a blackboard and he wrote the Hamiltonian of the SK model. And then I saw this Gaussian random variable and I get hypnotized by them because I had the, okay, hubris it's called. I saw that I know more about Gaussian random variable than anybody else. So I have an advantage in attacking this problem. That's totally ridiculous. That's the worst, most ridiculous thing I ever thought. Okay, because this is absolutely not the case, but that's why I started it. And we didn't communicate really on that. Erwin mentioned to me that this is a famous problem that many people have tried and have failed. But I don't think he had any specific ideas. He just found that was a fascinating problem. Okay, and apparently I found it fascinating, but I started, you know.
Just a quick clarification. So did Irwin know you? Were you, so yeah, why did he think
okay,
of
that's
you?
Okay, at the time, 1995, I had already done, that's 20 years after I started. So I had already done the best thing I did in probability I didn't know. Okay. Everything I did in probability was before 1995. Okay, so among the small circle of people doing that type of probability, I was known. Yes.
Okay.
That's why, yeah.
Okay, but so it was your general reputation. It's not that you were...
The general reputation, no, not at all because of the area. So you see, this is interesting because he said many people tried and failed. Now, I have a much more modest view of things. You have no chance whatsoever to solve a problem like that, just in one stroke. You have to approach the problem. And of course, I have no idea how to approach the problem, but I will give you an image, you know. My image is very simple. How do you walk from Paris to Vladivostok? It's a difficult project, right? But the first step is trivial. You take one step toward the east and you try to iterate. And it's exactly the mentality which I say, okay, I don't understand. I have no intuition whatsoever. I don't understand anything about the problem. More generally, I don't understand anything about statistical mechanics. I don't have any idea. Let me make the most trivial statement I cannot prove and try to prove it. That's what I did. And then when I succeeded, I did it again and again and again and again. So for a long period, I wrote a number of very technical and very difficult papers, which of course nobody has read and nobody should read because there is nothing important in these papers. They just don't do the right thing. It's a way to make progress. And after you explore, then you start to make some observation in the right direction. But you have no chance to make these observations if you don't start. So humility is the key to it. And humility, and also I have to say that the support of the community. Now that's very important because I submitted this paper to Annals of Probability and Probability Theory and the Related Field, which are the main journal in probability. And they accepted the papers. Now, I'm sure the referee must have said, okay, this is things we have not seen before. But if they ask how many people will read that, they know very well that nobody will read it. But if they turn the paper down, then I'll get discouraged. So they didn't feel they should do that. They should encourage them. And also, I had also a good reputation with these journals. Yeah. But to give you to the extent to which it went, there is, you know, probability theory in related field. It was Bolthausen was chief editor of that. And it comes into numbers. There are four numbers a year. There are these numbers, they are little books. And one book has two long papers of mine. I'm the only author of one, I should have kept it, of one little book of which the volume is made. You know, there's one fourth, it must be, of the yearly volume. That's my two papers and one on the Hope Film Roll. And okay, exactly the type of paper, so which nobody is going to read. But if one doesn't let this paper appear, then the field cannot develop. Okay, so it needs really trust from them and support from them, because if it doesn't go anywhere, this is bad for the journal. Okay, so that's really the thing which is very important.
So taking a step back, I just wanted to ask the question, so why did this particular problem capture your attention at this particular time in your career?
Well, it came at the right time. It came at the time where I was looking I was looking for a new topic because I had the main problem on which I'd been working for 10 years, and I felt I couldn't solve it. And this problem was solved by others much later, in 2011. I would never have been able to do something to do that. That's, you know, mathematics. There are mathematics that other people prove. There are things I feel in my area. There are things I feel sorry because I should have proved them, and things I'm happy that they prove them because I could never have proved them. And that's absolutely in the second category. Now, this is most beautiful piece of mathematics I've ever seen, this proof, and absolutely fantastic. So I was right that I shouldn't pursue. I needed a new topic. So I said, why not this one? Because, you see, knowing that some good people have tried, again, I felt they lack humility. They lack humility. They think they're going to solve it like that. No. Let us try to make progress in that direction. I was not scared. And also, okay, that's again. They gave my paper could get published. Okay, I could get funding from NSF. So there was really no reason not to keep working on that area. Okay, because I'm supposed to. So the system really supported me there.
So you made a few. So you made a few references to other people who's worked on these problems. So one of the person who also took up this problem at about the same time is Francesco Guerra, a few years before you. Were you aware, or when did you become aware of his contributions?
I don't remember. It's probably Erwin told me, because I remember reading the papers of Guerra from the beginning. Yes, very early. And these are important papers because they are the only papers on the having to do with that general area of which I could understand something. You see, because the first thing I did, of course, I took books. And the book is, Erwin mentioned, there is a Médard Parisi Viradro book. And I got the Médard Parisi Viradro. My library bought it, and I took it with me. And I carried it around the world for 2 years. And I even read it when my children were in the beach, you know. I could not understand a word of it. Not a word of it. Okay, I understood the cavity method is induction over the number of particles. But that's the first thing I would have tried anyway. So that was not helpful. And now maybe it's a good book for some people, but let us say it was not a good book for me. Because what might have helped me is explaining the very, very basics of statistical mechanics in a random with random disorders, very, very basics, which probably explain what is the physics of the high temperature regime. Just the things, okay, which I could not get from the book, and if I had taken maybe a course in statistical physics from the beginning, maybe I would have learned it, but it's difficult. I didn't have nobody to guide me. I didn't know where to look, you see. So, another thing I have to say about this book is the book is written to be cute somehow, but it doesn't help, you know, when you immediately you go into function of a negative number of variables and you are a mathematician, it doesn't help really to understand what's going on. It looks like something purely formal. And I really didn't get anything out of it. I could not actually, I'm to blame partly because I didn't really even understand the structure of the high temperature regime, which I'm sure it's a cultural problem. The cultural problem is unfathomable between mathematician and physicist. And I had a chance to experience that more later, but at the time, because I read some physics after that. But at the time, I was totally defenseless. So it's sort of, okay, again, it was not the most efficient process, but...
Because this was really your first exposure to the physics research literature at that point.
Yes, and that's... Oh, see, you see, I cannot say really it's a shock, you know, because when... I remember when, I was very, very lucky because I got a research position in France just before having done any research and just as a graduate student. So I arrived in Choquet Seminar, and then I tried to read the articles related to what people talk about there. And I could not understand the word of this article for years because every A references B, which references C, which, you know, there's a whole web and it's so difficult. So of course, when I tried to read the physics literature, I was not surprised that this is the same. I don't understand the word, but the difference is in mathematics, after studying a couple of years, I started understanding something. And in physics, maybe I didn't study long enough, but I never understood anything of what they wrote.
So if the book was if the Beyond, as the book is sometimes known, was not so helpful, how were the theoretical physics actors themselves helpful to you at any stage?
I had no contact with anybody at all. I didn't try, but I didn't know anybody. I contacted the obvious person, which was Marc Mézard, because Marc Mézard is in ANS, it's very easy to reach, and he was very kind to me. It means that he opened his door and I spent many hours on his blackboard trying to communicate things which I had done. But the communication was very difficult. So I have to say, at a personal level, he encouraged me and he was very kind, but I didn't succeed in understanding much of what he was telling me. And conversely, he didn't understand what were the obstacles I was meeting. For when I told him something I proved in high temperature regime, and he kept wondering why the things I could prove were so weak. And then I understand the model processes because mathematicians, when they make an estimate, they have to get a proof of it. It's not that it's likely to be true. You have to prove it. And you lose order of magnitude on what you can do between what you can prove and what is just likely to hold, you see? So communication was difficult. There were some other attempts in France. The French physicists several people were kind to me now, but it didn't. It scientifically, I couldn't say it helped. You see, but again, that's my okay. I have to say, you see, I have a special. Maybe it's not the system; it's just me. You know, it's a way. It's the same in mathematics. I'm completely unable to understand any piece of mathematics unless I start at the first line and I take everything apart and rebuild it my own way. And it's an extremely slow process, which is why I didn't learn anything, because I would need several lifetimes to learn things. But it has a good point. The good part is what I understand then after this process, then I understand better than other people because I've spent so much effort on it. Okay, that's being like that, of course, is not helpful to understand these somewhat not so precisely formulation that of which are so many in physics, you see. So that's my own problem. I'm not saying the thing is not good. I'm saying it was not for me. It was not helpful for me.
So speaking of the physics results themselves, were the predictions, if you want, or the ansatz from physics of any help to you in not even at that level?
That's my own stupidity. I didn't understand the even the structure of the replica symmetric solution. And then I had a very bad idea. I had a really very bad idea, in that instead of constant, okay, I should have, now I see the good program would have been try to prove the replica symmetric solution for the SK model at high enough temperature. That's the natural first step. And I had a very bad idea, which was, okay, I knew I was introduced to the hot field model because there were people like Anton Bovier and what is his name, Pierre Picot, who were studying the hot field model. And I learned about that. And the terrible idea was to think that the hot field model, there was one more parameter, it should be easier than the SK model. And that's totally, this is totally wrong, because in fact, it's probably much more difficult. That I spend a lot of energy on the hot field model. Okay, and I don't know if the energy I spend there benefited me later. But okay, I had to reinvent myself. Since I didn't understand the very basic that every physicist know, I had to figure it out by myself, which takes, of course, a very long time.
Yeah.
So during those first few years of struggle, if I may say, or at least of your ramping up that program, what was the reaction from the different communities, from, let's say, the theoretical physics, the mathematical, and the probability communities?
So I mentioned already the important thing was the support from the journals and the editors, but besides that, there was nobody had any idea among mathematicians. Nobody had any idea of what I was doing, simply because these papers are not okay. To read the paper I wrote, you have to be a very good analyst and work very hard, and that's and be interested in the topic. So that's an empty set, okay? Of course, physicists have no idea whatsoever, and also. Okay, so I mentioned that some physicists were very kind to me, but they have their own way to view things, which I understand and I respect, but with which I do not really agree. So that's a classified information I will give now. There was a determining event, which is in 1999, my advisor, who was a member of the Academy of Science, put me up for one of the big prizes that the Academy of Science gives. You know, people don't know that, but the Academy of Science gives more money every year than the Swedish Academy of Science. Huh? Yes, so there are some called Grand Prix, which a great honor, and there are substantial amount of money, maybe 50,000 euro or something like that. It's a good price. So Choquet put me from that price, and the price is called the Ampère Prize, and I think Marc Mézard got it, if I'm correct. It's 1 year for mathematician and 1 year for physicist, and that was the year for mathematician. But the committee is always made of mathematician and a physicist. And the physicists who were on the committee that year opposed my getting the prize, because they explained that, I don't know which word they used, because I was not at the meeting. I just got some overall information, but actually from Gustave Choquet himself. And he said, they say that what you did is uninteresting. Because the things I'd done at the time was only this work on the Hope Field model, which is technically very hard, but what a physicist consider, for a physicist, everything having to do with high temperature is trivial, and the thing of interest is a low temperature. Now, overall, I agree, but, you know, even getting the wall of the high temperature region for the SK model, it's not trivial at all. Okay, but that I had not done it at the time. I had done just this work on the Hope Field model, and they didn't evaluate the way I would have liked. So again, I understand why they thought that way, but what made me sad, what made me really sad about that is if I had not worked at all on spin glasses, I'm absolutely certain I would have got the prize because I did more. If you think only of mathematics, I probably had done more than the mathematician who got the prize that year. You know, so it, having spent all that effort on spin glasses had a really great negative value on that specific occasion. Okay, that's life.
So in just a few years later, you wrote a first book about spinning glasses that was, I guess, reformulating the advances you had made over the previous years and formalizing maybe in a slightly different language. Why was this a natural moment to
it's
write a book?
It's a natural moment, okay. You know, there are several considerations. As I said, I try to keep going forward, and a good way to do that is review everything from the beginning and put it in your brain together, hoping that there will be some sparks. That's the main motivation for writing the book. Now, secondary motivation, I know very well that nobody will read one line of the papers, but if one put all together in a book with coherent notation and maybe starting a little bit easier, then maybe somebody will read something of the book, or at least they will have to quote the book because it's harder to ignore a yellow book than a paper. Okay, so all this together, and I'm a terrible writer. If I want to write, which I learned only recently, I'm really a terrible writer, which means if I want to write something which can be read, I have to put tremendous effort in it, which I didn't for that book. So I didn't spend such a very long time for the book. Okay, but again, probably I would not have made further progress if I had not written the book again. Be humble, and if you cannot reach your goal, doesn't matter. Just try to get unstuck and go somewhere and iterate. These simple ideas, you keep using them.
So the book did succeed then in its
initial... The book did succeed, at least probably it helped me, yeah.
Okay. I mean, one thing that followed closely the book's publication is you started collaborating with Giorgio Parisi. You had an article with him. Can you tell us a bit more about what led to that?
Okay. Giorgio Parisi came to give a lecture in EHP soon after I had proved the validity of the Parisi solution. Now, I forgot what was the event. But it was about spin glasses, and Parisi showed what a generous and great person is, because he mentioned about the Parisi solution, and he added, "Now we are sure it is true." And that was really, it should be known that he said that, because he acknowledged there is a difference between a mathematical proof and being physically certain that it's correct. He acknowledged there is a difference. So after his talk, I went to talk to him, and which of course is a great experience. And I forgot what we discussed, but there is a tiny speck of something he said which I could understand, in contrast with all these fantastic things that are in his paper but are not within my reach. So I could understand this thing, and I could miss something. So I wrote a little paper and I sent to him, and he approved. And that's how the paper was. I think it's a good idea, but it can be pushed further indeed. But it's something which I could measure, you know, how what a source of idea is, because that tiny little thing, I would never have thought about doing that. So I was just a scribe for that paper.
So in 2006, you published that rigorous demonstration of the validity of Parisi's formula for the free energy of the SK model. Could you tell us what enabled this advance? Or, I mean, you mentioned that the book being a spark, but...
you see, the thing is, you have to find an approach. That's why the people who try to solve the problem without being humble enough didn't find it, because the approach has to be based on something. And one in writing one of these monstrous technical paper, I made a trivial observation, which is when you get an upper bound on the free energy of two coupled copies of a system, that in certain way can help you get a lower bound on the energy of a single system. And that's the basic of the approach. And then Guerra came up with his replica symmetric upper bound for the SK model. Now, once you understand this paper, you can do the same thing for coupled copies. And that was the upper bound which was needed to make the trivial observation work. That's essentially what it is. And then when I put 2 + 2 = 4, it took 1 week to get the proof, except that I realized I had missed a little detail, so I sweat a little bit, but then in the end it was okay. Now, if you are interested, since that's history, we can a little bit comment on how science works, because I figured out, of course, now, I know that's a big problem. I know I'm not likely to do many more like that. So I submitted to the Annals of Mathematics. And the Annals of Mathematics did their job. They sent it to the obvious referee. Who can guess with the obvious referee? Michael Eisenman. And Michael Eisenman, I don't know how much effort he put in reading the paper, but it happened that there was a conference in Zurich soon after I submitted the paper. And Michael Eisenman came to me and he said, "You claim to do that. I don't understand your proof." So I managed to communicate to him the overall structure of the approach. And then he said, "Now I understand." And the paper was accepted. Now, I don't know if the paper was read at all, but that's how science works. No, it's perfectly fine. I mean, the best expert has to be reasonably convinced that the paper is sound, and then that's the job is, he cannot be asked to do more, to check line by line that everything is okay. So
that paper in particular is dedicated to Francesco Guerra.
Because without Guerra's replica symmetric bound, the paper would not exist. And Guerra's replica symmetric bound, it belongs to the category of, I explained, that I am not sorry I didn't do it, because I could never have reached that level. Now, to be able to find that bound, you have to understand really the structure of the Parisi solution, the Michael Eisenman would say, you call the cascade, probability cascade. There is this probability structure underlying that the physicists understood very well, and Guerra must have understood, and which gave him a way to find this bound. And since I had not understood that at all at the time, then I could not have found this bound. So it was absolutely correct that this is dedicated to Guerra, you know. And this is sort of funny, because in my eyes, Guerra did the difficult part of that proof, which is to find that. The other part is really a schoolboy idea. But somehow, this schoolboy idea, it was not so easy to find it. You see? Life is hard, yeah.
So, but at that point, did you know Francesco Guerra personally, or this was all through papers of his that you
No, that I will not remember when I met him first time. He came to Paris several times. And of course, when I learned he came, I met him. But I will. There is no way I will recollect when this was. Yeah.
Okay. So, but so throughout that 10-year period, you got to know him.
Yes, sure.
To some degree. Okay.
Yes.
So, what was? I mean, in notes that you sent us, you mentioned another result by Guerra, the Ghirlanda Guerra identities, as being.
Okay. Leaked. Now that's another of the same category. He does. Okay, you do something which just so looks so simple. You take an equality of two things and you integrate. But how can one invent such a thing? You know, that's okay. When I see this kind of result, I'm just feel so lucky that chance and fate took me to result I could prove when other people can prove this kind of stuff. I don't deserve to be a mathematician. That's why I mentioned that. I have infinite admiration for these two results of Guerra. Now, okay. That's the only two results I know. Huh? So it doesn't mean that the rest he did is not of that level. Maybe it is, but I don't know.
So, but did you use that inequality? That identity.
Actually, yeah, I used. I got some consequences of that, but I didn't go. I didn't go far enough. It can be used better, yes. But I played with them, yes. Okay. You get some amazing information out of that, yes. It's, interestingly, they didn't do. Guerra and Ghirlanda and Guerra didn't do that. They prove the inequality and they don't draw any consequence, which is sort of sad. Yes.
So, following that seminal work from 2006, what was the reaction of the various communities at that point? Did this, you know, from the theoretical physicist, the mathematical physicist, and the probabilists?
Now I have no data about that because I was not. I'm okay. The best people with whom I was in contact mathematically had no idea of that that kind of work. So the people in the Spinglass conference, of course, they knew about it and they liked it, but the. Okay. Then I can add. Now I was elected to the French Academy in 2005, which was just after I had. Solution is published in 2006, but I must have done it in 2004. So it was already known I had done it. And the same person who didn't want me to get that prize now said, now what he has done is interesting. You see, now, which of course what he had done before was not interesting, so he didn't change his mind, but now this was interesting. So they liked it.
Is more favorable for sure.
More favorable, yes.
So, in that second phase, right between the book and that result, you also start collaborating with Dmitry Panchenko. Can you tell us a bit how this collaboration came about, and in what ways were you know, complementary in that work?
Okay, now Dmitry Panchenko had started as. Well, more or less the same kind of probability I was doing. And now there is an interesting question. Why did he become interested in spin glasses? That you would have to ask him because I must have asked him, but I don't remember what. But he got interested in spin glasses. And, you know, you have this. Now, I became interested in spin glasses. I already had built my career and had a good position. Now, when I see this guy studying, getting interested in rigorous results for spinning glasses, I saw this is too difficult. He may get killed there. So I tried to discourage him. And I told him, you know, this is a very difficult topic. And he said, oh, no. So he kept working at it. And I really felt now this guy deserves something. So, so I tried to help him. Now, the way I helped him is I tried to teach him everything I know. So I came up with a reasonably easy project, which are the joint papers. And then I invited him in my house for 1 week, and we spoke about spin glasses all day. And it's a great investment, because soon after I realized that he understood better and more, and he did some great work again where I was absolutely not in the right direction and I could not have done. So I'm very glad he was successful. And I'm very glad I was a small part of that.
It's a very nice outcome, yes.
Yes, now the instinct of, it's very difficult to know who is going to be successful or not, because the talent and the personality are not enough. You need also a little bit of luck, as I explained. But in the case of Penchenko, it's not luck. He went to the right direction. There is a saying I love, which is there are three ages in the life of a physicist. You know this one? There is the age to learn, there is the age to discover, and there is the age to prevent other people from discovering. Because at some point you know everything, you see, and you become prejudiced. And that's exactly what happened to me. You know, the line that Panchenko followed successfully, I knew about it, but I dismissed it. I said, no, this cannot possibly work. Instead of being humble and pursuing it, and let me see what done. No, I dismissed it without investigating it. Well, I got what I deserved. Which doesn't mean that I could have done what Panchenko did, but that there is some moral to be learned from that story.
So a few years later, you published a second edition, a two-volume edition of your book on spinning glasses, which more or less coincided with the end of your efforts in the field of spinning glasses.
Called The Ultimate Bad Timing. Now, the idea to write a second edition is very simple. It's, the most interesting thing is the Parisi solution, and it was not included in the book. So I say, it has to be in book form. But then I made some bad decision. I used another approach, which turned out it is... More difficult than the original approach, and then I tried to rewrite everything and sort of expand it. But already this was the time where Panchenko helped me reading. Shocking, you know. He helped me reading the draft, and then I realized as I write the draft that. He starts to understand. Then the thing I'm so happy that I understood when I wrote the second edition, I had not understood before. He already knows them. I really figured that. And then he starts showing that he has understood things I had not understood. And it's clear that he was understanding the topic better than I was. So the effort of that book is largely wasted. But maybe things like in the Hopfield model, which I don't think anybody has made progress. Now there is a very detailed account on everything that you can rigorously prove, and maybe someday it will be useful. You know. But then when I, Dimitri proving the ultrametricity was really determining in my decision to stop working on Spinning-Glasson and actually to stop doing mathematics at all, because at the same time, the problem I got stuck on in 1995 when I started Spinning-Glasson was solved 2011 by two Polish mathematicians, Rafał Latala and Witold Bednarz. And again, that's the fantastic piece of mathematics. So I felt, you know, I have been solving others' problems. Now the two problems I wanted most to solve, now two other people solved them. Is that a sign of something? And well, it's a sign that maybe it's better time to stop doing research. That's the way, and which I mostly did. Now, stop doing research and stop working is slightly different. Okay, but I had some traumatic experience of many seeing mathematicians who work when they should have stopped. And they think what they do is as good as what they did, and they are the only one to think that, you know. And it's not desirable to put yourself into such a position. So don't ask me anything about Spinning-Glasson beyond that. I know Dmitry has published. I know I could mention a few names that have been working on that, but I have no idea what they did. And there's Antonio Hofinger who is publishing in that. And I read a paper on a different topic he wrote. And this guy is amazingly good. There is no other word. This other paper is just fabulous. And I have no reason to think that what he does on Spinning-Glasson is any lower level. So it's becoming far too difficult now. I'm glad I didn't try to pursue. Yeah, too good.
So in your perspective, how important or not has become the problem of Spinning-Glasson in the probability community as we're working through it and since you left?
Okay, you know, at the turn of the century, there was these big millennium conferences, right? And I was invited to one which called Mathematics in the 21st Century, of course. And the article I published there is called Spinning-Glasson, A New Direction to Probability Theory which means somehow I had the hope that it would span a branch of probability, but there was no ground for that. It was just wishful thinking. I don't think it has any impact on probability. It just became a subfield of probability, like percolation theory. So now you have some, as I said, extremely good people working on that. But I don't know if in the long term, if it will keep. Okay, I'm sure there are many. There are many problems which are left because there are some models like the Hopfield model where it's very hard to say anything, but will we be able to solve this problem? No, Anton Bovier told me one time, you know, he said, you know, there is no reason why we should be able to rigorously solve these models. And maybe he was right. Maybe it cannot be done, or it cannot be done in the foreseeable future. So nobody knows what will happen. But it's certain that it didn't have a major influence on probability theory. It just created a new field.
During your time in Paris or Paris or Ohio State, did you ever get to teach about Spinning-Glasson?
Now, one of the things I'm proud of is that I succeeded in not doing a lot of things that all other people do. And of course, the one I succeeded the best is administrative work, of which I did none ever. The second one I succeeded the best is not having to teach. My position in Paris doesn't require, I can teach on a voluntary basis, which means I'm permitted to teach basically for free. Now, in Ohio State, I had to teach. Now, I had a brilliant solution for that. Many people try to prove, to show to themselves how good they are by teaching advanced courses. Now, I try to maximize the efficiency. And the maximum efficiency is second year, last year of calculus, because the material is trivial, but the worst student have been eliminated because it's the last year of calculus. Because the really bad student, it's really more than I could take. So now, for teaching on a voluntary basis, if I had students like Ofinger or Panchenko, I would volunteer any time to teach. But the French system is designed in such a way that the student to whom I teach are the university student. They are not the student of École Normale. And okay, the odds of finding Panchenko among them are low enough that it's not worth trying, which I didn't try.
So as we're nearing the end of our discussion, is there anything else that you would like to share with us about this era that we may have missed that might be of interest?
Okay, was there anything in the note? No, okay, I wrote some things in the note which I didn't, but you can add them, it's okay. No, see, as I was saying, I'm really not a good person to contribute for this history because somehow I know so little of it. All the things which exactly happened to me, that's the only thing I know. Because I was not part of the... And also maybe it's like in probability. Maybe I was successful in probability because I was not part of it. And somehow coming from outside is a terrible disadvantage. Like I suffered a lot, but by some respect, it's also an advantage. You see, this is, again, I say life is hard. I mean, there is no algorithm to tell you which path you should follow to succeed and to solve problems.
So maybe one thing that comes up is that you did receive the Shaw Prize a couple of years ago, which acknowledges your work on spinning glasses at that point.
This is due to... the stars were aligned, but it's not enough. It's somebody had to volunteer and to put me up, which means he had to document and do some work. And this is very interesting. Is, of course, I know who it is, and it's a mathematician who is not afraid to tackle extremely difficult problems where there is very little hope of succeeding. And somehow he had applied the same strategy there, and against all odds, he succeeded. Oh, that's extraordinary. So I heard, I thanked people who might have written for me, and somebody said the physics people did their share too. So I guess Parisi did something. Yeah, that's what it means.
So from a documentary standpoint, do you have any notes, papers, or correspondence? Oh, sorry, Francesco.
Sorry, Patrick, before you move to the next, I just wanted to ask you one question that maybe we skipped. There was a paper by Ruel, Eisenman, and Leibovitz on the...
Yes.
On the... where they were trying to prove something on the high temperature
phase. The high temperature regime without external field. But that's without external field, this paper. So without external field, it's completely different. That's one paper I'd read so many times, and I understood the paper, but it didn't open a path to anywhere to me. You know, this is a purely math rigorous paper, so I really got the picture, but line by line, and there was no problem to follow it. But it was not helpful in any way to go further.
That's not the way I should. Never tried to discuss with the authors of that paper about extension of that work, or I mean,
try no,
to.
No, I Okay, maybe I should have contacted the people, and it's a little bit. You have to think this is a little bit before email. It was harder to contact people, and contacting since then I tried to contact people for other reasons, and it's not always, you don't always get responses. It's not so easy, you see. If you are not in a position where you meet certain person easily, it is hard. If you meet certain person easily, you can go until something happens. But I didn't try to talk to them. And also, there is this mental obstacles, this very famous person in a very famous university. It's sort of difficult to. I'm just a nobody in CNRS. Nobody knows what CNRS is. Okay, so I didn't try.
So, last question was a question about documentation, as we were just discussing. Do you still have notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes,
now I don't remember I had notes, but then I'll tell you this sad story is which happened about 3 years ago. Is the house in which my father was living with his wife. With his wife is Yvonne Choquet-Bruat, who did some very important work in general relativity. And she exchanged correspondence with Einstein, I know. And, so they had all their a lifetime of work of files were in the house, in their offices, in their house, and then. So Choquet was already dead, and his wife had to go to retirement place because she couldn't stay by herself. So the house in which they lived, the children took care of it. And the way they took care of it, they called somebody to empty the house, and all the files went to the dumpster. Now, that's interesting because one of the children is a scientist, and he knows very well that there were people in the academy. There is an archive section. They are just happy you give them a call, and there is some document from famous Professor Choquet waiting, and then they will put it in boxes and keep them for 100 years until somebody wants to study them. You know, it doesn't take that much. But he didn't do that, so the files were dumped, and some of the Choquet files were recovered from the dumpster, but then it rained, and the files of his wife were all lost, including the correspondence with Einstein. So when I learned of that, I was totally dejected. So I said, okay, I went to university and I dumped all my own files because I said, okay, that's going to be dumped by a random process. I'm going to dump them. This is better than if somebody else did it. Okay, so, but anyway, I had nothing of interest. I know things. Among the many mistakes I made in my life, scientific life, is all mistakes are always made in the same direction, not being humble enough. And I should have been more patient and make no books of notes. Whenever there is a question, try to formulate it in writing very nicely. And then whenever there is observation, however trivial, try to put it in writing. And it's great. I know some people who do that, and I really regret I didn't do that, because that's a way. You make little steps, and you steer the stuff in your brain, then the sparkle happen. And I didn't do that now, so I don't have these could have been interesting notes, but they were never written. And I would have maybe I would have done better mathematics if I had known that before.
Professor Talagrand, thank you very much for the discussion.
Okay, that was fun. Thank you so much, and good luck with the transcription. And I hope it eventually serves some purpose.